Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life. And by Penn Medicine.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. The Atlantic hurricane season is here, and forecasters have made their predictions.
We're expecting a near-average season, which means a lot of storms forming in the Atlantic.
So I really urge every American to take this hurricane season very seriously.
As storms form, millions of people will be glued to their screens. They'll listen to weather forecasts,
watch the Weather Channel, or follow storms on the internet because they're addicted to the weather. They need to know the weather.
Knowing if and when a storm might hit can quickly become a matter of life and death. Hurricanes can devastate communities, but often what really makes a difference is how we respond.
A hurricane that passes over an uninhabited island isn't a disaster. It's simply a natural phenomenon. What makes it a disaster is what we have done or not done before and what we do after or not do after that turns it into a disaster.
So what do we need to do to be ready for the next hurricane? What's the best way to regroup after it hits? On this episode, a look at how we deal with these powerful storms. As we prepare for this year's hurricane season, there is still so much to clean up from last year's destruction. Maria hit Puerto Rico with full force and devastated the island's power grid. About 80% of transmission lines came down, leaving people without electricity for months and months. As the island's one utility company struggled to turn the lights back on, people started to talk about rebuilding a better grid. Irina Zhurov takes us to Puerto Rico.
So welcome to our control center, energy control center.
Gary Soto is the operations manager for the island's power utility. It's called PREPA, and the control center is its heart. An analog diagram of the power grid stretches the length of the room. It looks pretty dated, like the wall of a cartoon Soviet bunker in some unidentified important place.
Yeah, it may be like 30 years old.
But they do have desktop computers here. Gary logs in. On the night of Hurricane Maria, he witnessed Puerto Rico's power go out on this computer screen.
We opened this console. This is the emergency console.
The console on the monitor showed the island's outline dotted with little boxes. They represented power plants. A tangle of lines ran from the boxes like an intricate cat's cradle. Those were the high-voltage transmission cables. They carry electricity from the power plants to different parts of Puerto Rico. The lines appeared in yellow, red, and green, depending on their voltage. Outside, rain and wind pummeled the building. Neftali Castillo was also working that night.
Once the wind started up, the system started to extinguish little by little.
Those yellow, red, and green lines.
They go from color, they go to gray.
Gray means the line is down.
Everyone is talking. You have to be certain of what's happening, give good instructions.
The engineers who control the distribution of power were yelling about how much power should go where on the grid.
So there was a lot of talk.
They were worried because power grids must be balanced. The amount of power being made has to equal the power being used. Because if the grid gets out of balance,
it will collapse.
And that's what happened.
Everything went down in a chain reaction until finally the whole system went offline.
Everyone in Puerto Rico lost power. All 3.3 million people.
And that's at 2 a.m. in the morning. So after 2 o'clock, the main noise that was going on was Maria.
About 2 hours from San Juan, in the center of the island, Santa Ortolaza was also listening to the storm in the dark.
We went to sleep, but couldn't because we were unsettled. You know when you feel this? The zinc metal sheets flying every which way.
So instead, she and her neighbors reminisced about past hurricanes.
And with the radio turned on, battery operated.
They made it through the night. In the morning, they saw the storm had knocked down trees and utility poles, blocking the road.
We went to cut a passage in the fallen trees, open up the road to help.
She'd lived through other hurricanes. She knew power might be out for a bit, like in past storms. It's just how it worked here.
Yo solo pongo las cosas en aquel.
I put all things on him, on the Creator, because he's the one who does all things. Others insult him, they become rebellious. But what does one get out of that?
But days turned into weeks, and weeks into months, and still the power didn't return. The recovery was moving at a glacial pace. Part of the reason for that is how the grid was built. Another part is how it's deteriorated. Let's start at the beginning. Puerto Rico's modern grid is owned by the state. It was built starting in the 1940s. First, it used dams for power, but soon that wasn't enough.
Venezuela is only less than 500 miles from the southern coast of Puerto Rico by a very easy Caribbean Sea that is very quiet, so you could bring ships of oil to the southern part of the island.
That's Luis Aviles. He used to run the island's utility and now teaches law at the University of Puerto Rico. He says Puerto Rico erected new power plants along the southern coast, fed by Venezuelan oil. There was a problem, though.
The population was concentrated, still is, mostly concentrated on the northern part of the island.
Less than 40 miles separate the north and south coast. But the middle, where Santa lives, is crinkled by mountains.
We don't have very high mountains. The highest peak is at 4,000 feet. But they're very steep.
The utility strung transmission lines across the mountains. They made power in the south, and they traveled by cable to the people in the north.
For electrical purposes, we are two islands.
But it worked. People had reliable power. So did a rapidly growing manufacturing sector. First garment factories, then pharmaceutical companies, driven by tax incentives from the U.S. It didn't last. Congress phased out the tax incentives starting in the 1990s, right after the recession hit. Many manufacturers fled to greener tax pastures. The grid now had fewer customers paying for power, and its finances were being seriously mismanaged, often for political gain. Today, it's $9 billion in debt.
And then you have to upkeep that infrastructure, which is like, right now, it's like 40 years old. And you don't have revenues to do that. It's a perfect storm. And then we got the hurricanes, you know.
Maria roared in as a Category 5. The aging grid couldn't withstand it. Towers collapsed on the mountaintops where they had precariously perched. Cables snapped. Transformers blew up. The destruction was vast. When the wind settled, workers realized there wasn't enough equipment stockpiled, not enough staff. The inaccessible, mountainous terrain complicated everything. For months, much of the island stayed dark. I got to Puerto Rico on the 6-month anniversary. I drove from San Juan, about 90 minutes to the center of the island. Once you get off the highway, the roads turn winding, narrow. Barricades squeeze the road further where mudslides have taken a bite out of the asphalt. At first, the gravity of the destruction is not immediately apparent. Your eyes have to adjust to the chaos, as if to darkness. Only then can you pick out the cables strewn across the road and hanging, severed, between trees. Poles lean in every direction. I pulled off in a verdant hillside and found Santa Ortolaza.
I don't know where my utility pole went to. And the cables? Look at them there.
Santa was still waiting for workers to reach her.
Well, waiting for the light to come. Crossing our fingers. All this gets dark. Dark, dark, dark.
She's had to change her routines.
We've got all these things and we can't use them. The washer.
I notice her shirt is pocked with stains. Laundry is difficult, she says. She eats less fresh produce because her fridge isn't cold. She warms water for baths on the stove. She points to a couple of solar-powered lawn ornaments charging in her yard.
Yo tengo esta.
I have these that I put in the bathroom.
In her kitchen, she shows me a cable tucked through the window. It looks a little unsafe.
La vecina de aquí pasa un cable de la planta.
My neighbor runs a cable from her generator to the fridge, and from there, I charge a light bulb, and that's how we get light.
The neighbor only turns on the generator for a couple of hours after work, so Santa uses a chargeable bulb. Her sister, Minerva, brings out the strange contraption.
When it gets charged and they turn off the generator, we have light.
At night, Santa reads the Bible by her one charged bulb.
We go to bed early at like 7 or 7:30. What else am I going to do? There isn't much.
As people like Santa stressed and learned to live without the utility's power, the rhetoric in the capital and on the mainland turned, in some strange ways, optimistic. The destruction of the grid was so immense that some people saw an opportunity.
The first thought most certainly was, you know, gosh, here we are, unfortunately, in a situation where we are closer to a blank slate situation than we ever thought we actually would be.
Julia Hamm heads an organization that promotes renewable energy. It's called the Smart Electric Power Alliance. For years, her group has led a thought experiment called the 51st State Initiative. It's not about statehood. It's about dreaming up a better way to manage a power grid without the baggage of existing grids.
The electric power sector is over 100 years old, and over the course of that 100 years, there has been a lot of change.
A few months after the storm, based on some of the initiative's ideas, Julia helped write a report that sketched out how Puerto Rico could build back a better, more resilient grid. One of the major proposals is to add clean energy, like solar and wind, and to decentralize the grid. That last part is really key. Think of Puerto Rico's grid as a long chain of Christmas lights, plugged in. Cut its cable, and the lights go out. Now, instead of one string of lights, imagine many smaller loops of bulbs, all interconnected and strung about a room, but each with a backup plug. Cut one cable, and the rest can keep twinkling.
And so it's a whole series of systems that are working together.
In other words, instead of one centralized grid like Puerto Rico has now, the idea is to have a bunch of microgrids within the main grid. Perhaps one for a hospital, one for a small city, maybe a remote town. They could be powered by renewable energy. As the utility struggled to restore power, some people unknowingly put that plan into action. I went to check out a microgrid. It happens to be at a school right across from Santa's powerless house. In the school's main office, administrators work on a computer and lights buzz on in the classroom when I pass. The kids are on a field trip, so workers are power washing the buildings. Adam Gettner leads me around them up some steep steps.
Oh.
So that's what's powering this area here. It's a 15 kilowatt PV array.
Can you just describe what it looks like?
It is about 8 rows of panels, solar panels.
Adam works for Sonnen, a German power storage company. A local company donated the panels and Sonnen the batteries to store the energy and power the school. We go into a classroom to check out the battery.
So it just kind of looks like a refrigerator.
Exactly. The screen on the front tells you everything you'd need to know just to kind of plan your energy usage. And the circle here tells you what operating mode you're in. Right now we're in off-grid, obviously, because there's no grid here to connect to.
The school's running on its own microgrid, since the main grid is still down. When the main grid is working, these smaller grids, which would have their own generation, like the solar panels, could connect to it and even supply some power to it.
If the grid goes down, so if another hurricane were to pass, the grid was going to go down again. If a hurricane comes, these lines are going to fall. And if they do, the idea behind a microgrid is that it can disconnect from this overall grid and provide power to the people who are within this microgrid.
That's exactly what the school is doing right now. The school's principal, Alberto Melendez Castillo, says with the new setup, the school will save nearly 30,000 desperately needed dollars annually. And The school will be prepared for future storms.
If another event like Maria comes, we'll have power so the students can have classes with light, can eat fresh food, can drink cold water, cold milk. That's what we want.
The school serves low-income kids from the mostly rural area. Alberto says he wants it to function as an emergency center for the whole community.
If the parents don't have power, don't have a place to plug in this equipment, like an oxygen machine, let them come to the school and have these services. And then take them back to the community.
If Puerto Rico really wants to build a modern grid, it'll cost roughly $17 billion. For now, PREPA's priority has been turning the lights back on. That means dollars being spent now aren't going to rebuilding better. They're making the same thing that was there. Julia Hamm again.
I mean, there probably is some money being spent today to fix the current equipment that if we really re-envision Puerto Rico's power system going forward, that might need to change anyway and be redone to something else. But there's really no other alternative.
From the school, I wind back down from the mountain. My phone doesn't work because communications lines are down too. Miraculously, I don't get lost, and in 40 minutes, I'm in the town of Orocovis. I end up at the house of Maria Esnadel Melendez Colon. Here, it's easy to see the grid is not some abstract thing. It's life. Maria lets me in and leads me out back. Two generators scream in a little shed. She uses one at night and one during the day. She points to a small mountain of jugs full of diesel. That'll last her 2 days, she says. Back inside, she explains why.
My mom is bedridden. She's a patient who needs oxygen 24/7. We have critical moments because the cost is enormous.
She pays about $900 a month just for fuel for the generators.
We never would have expected that this would take so long. This situation has been so extended and makes one desperate because there are moments when one has to think, how am I going to overcome this? It's not easy.
We go into her mother's room. Olga is sitting up in bed, surrounded by hissing medical equipment. She's almost 97. That means she lived through San Felipe in 1928. That was the last really, really big hurricane to hit Puerto Rico. She also lived through the electrification of the island. When I try to ask her about it, she whispers,
"Ayúdame."
Help me.
"Ayúdame."
That was Irina Zhorov reporting. We're talking about how we prepare for storms and what we can do to recover after they hit. One of the big issues with hurricanes in urban areas is flooding and managing stormwater runoff. Cities like Seattle, Philadelphia, Atlanta, and New York are all using compost to soak up rain. So Sullivan looked into the potential of compost in New Orleans.
There's a bunch of trash on top of compost bins.
She met up with Nico Crable from Schmelly's Composting as he picked up his goods on Bourbon Street.
When we started, we discovered that people didn't really pay attention. These got put out on the street and people would just lift them up and throw trash in them.
While passersby see trash, Nico and others say the leftover mashed potatoes and salad are a valuable workhorse ingredient for making good soil. New Orleans floods regularly. On top of that, concrete and asphalt surfaces act like funnels during a storm, shooting water towards drains. When all that water hits at once, it can overwhelm the system and send polluted water straight into local streams, rivers, and lakes. It's a growing problem in a lot of places, and cities want to slow that water down, make it wait to enter the drainage system. And that's where compost comes in.
Soils with organic matter, they act like sponges.
Researcher Melissa Bauston is with the Water Institute of the Gulf in southern Louisiana. She says decomposing food and plants in compost help keep heavy soils from getting compacted.
The organic matter in the soils produce lots of little holes or pore space.
So how do you turn potato salad into soil?
It's a pretty fascinating process where you mix a nitrogen-based material like food scraps with a carbonous material like wood chips or coffee chaff.
In New Orleans, farmer and compost maven Nico Krebel is showing me the pile of decomposition and microbial activity.
Let that sit for 4 to 6 months. Turn it whenever you can. Get some oxygen in there for the little bugs and the microbes, and you get compost.
Compost is also pretty good at filtering contaminants in dirty stormwater runoff.
Nutrients are a problem. Pathogens are a problem, like fecal coliform.
Frank Franciosi from the U.S. Composting Council says regular topsoil may have 1 or 2% organic matter. But he says good compost is roughly half organic matter. Compost ends up in green architecture, rain gardens, and other urban designs built to be spongy.
And there's a lot of different structures that they can put in. Green roofs is one of them.
Another is bioswales, those man-made, shallow, wide ditches. And Frank says they're usually built with engineered soil. That is, layers of compost, coarse and fine stone aggregates, and sand.
That mixture will allow the water to flow through the grass, through the roots, into the grounds.
New research from the University of Wisconsin suggests that even a bunch of small green spaces, like backyards, can make a big difference in absorbing water when storms hit. For The Pulse, I'm Zoe Sullivan.
In past centuries, long before we could track every hurricane as a churning eye moving along our screens, people thought hurricanes were an act of God.
Some kind of admonishment or punishment for our sins.
That's historian Stuart Schwartz. He's an expert on the Caribbean, and he wrote a history of hurricanes called Sea of Storms. Before we understood them scientifically, did people think that they could prepare for hurricanes? I mean, they must have noticed that they always come around the same time of year.
Right. Well, what people did when the Europeans first arrived in the New World, they depended on the Native Americans to tell them about hurricanes. I even remember a letter from a governor on one of the British islands who had complained that there were no more Indians left on the island, and he wanted permission to go to some other island and get some because there was no way to predict the hurricanes unless they had some there. So in other words, the indigenous peoples had learned the signs to read the swell of the sea or the shape of the clouds, etc. And so they depended on that kind of information. And also, they began early to understand that there were natural signs. Seabirds who would move inland, for example, before a hurricane. Or even cattle would come from the heights and come down to the lowlands.
Stuart says hurricanes often define moments in political history. A hurricane can make or break a leader, depending on how well a country is prepared for a storm and how much help there is available in the aftermath. And sometimes a hurricane offers an opportunity. Here's an example from the Dominican Republic in 1930.
The Hurricane of San Zenon, it was called. The hurricane took place right after an election, which brought a military man, Rafael Trujillo, to power. And the city of Santo Domingo was devastated by this hurricane.
2,000 people died in the storm. Trujillo placed the Dominican Republic under martial law, and he began to rebuild Santo Domingo.
The city was then renamed for him. It was called Ciudad Trujillo. Monuments to him were erected. All his political opponents were eliminated or crushed, and he consolidated his power as dictator of the Dominican Republic for the next 30 years on the basis of the disaster of the Hurricane of San Zenon.
In the 1930s, hurricanes also had a big impact on American politics and attitudes toward disaster response.
The creation of the of the New Deal under Franklin Delano Roosevelt was in part a reaction to a series of natural disasters that happened in the United States.
I want to say a few words tonight to you, my fellow Americans, who believe in social welfare and social justice.
That's FDR speaking in 1938 after a hurricane devastated New England.
Hardly had the hurricane subsided when all of the forces of government, assisting and cooperating with private agencies, were rushed to the aid of the injured, the sick, and the homeless. How many lives were saved because of these efforts, no one can say.
And the argument made in the creation of the welfare state was, what difference did it make whether the disaster was an earthquake or a flood or a hurricane, or whether it was the crash of the stock market? The problem was the same, and that the government had some responsibility to step in at that point.
Now we hold politicians responsible when help doesn't come fast enough. George W. Bush faced a lot of criticism after Katrina. Same with the Trump administration's response to Maria. Stewart says historically, the country that does the best in the face of hurricanes, that devotes the most resources to preparing for them, is Cuba.
Evacuations are not voluntary. They're required. And they've do such things as, for example, trimming trees before the hurricane season to try to protect the power lines from coming down. They provided little things like shelters for people's pets, because often people are reluctant to leave their homes because they don't want to leave their pets behind. And so Cuba's response in terms of loss of life has been much better than other places in the Caribbean. It's not a matter, however, of socialism versus capitalism, because Vietnam doesn't have a good record on responding to natural disasters, whereas Japan, which is a capitalist economy, has a relatively good record in responding to natural disasters. It really depends on the willingness of the government to invest the funding and the planning before natural disasters. And when that isn't there, that's when you have the worst results.
Stuart Schwartz is a professor of history at Yale University. His book is called Sea of Storms. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Preparing for a storm and recovering from its wrath is even more challenging when the infrastructure is already struggling. Puerto Rico's healthcare system was on the brink before Hurricane Maria. After the storm, the challenges are even greater. Some hospitals and clinics were totally destroyed. Others tried to operate without power or roofs. Many patients had to leave the island to get treatment and help elsewhere. One of them was baby Jacob. He was born prematurely in Puerto Rico last June. Emily Curtin met his family in Macon, Georgia, at a neonatal intensive care unit as they were on their way to seek better care for Jacob.
7 months after giving birth, Roxanne Vasquez can't hold her son in her arms. She scrubs like a surgeon to even go near him. She's in a hospital 1,000 miles from home, where the machines are much louder than the babies. Their lack of crying hits me like a punch in the gut. Roxanne ushers me into baby Jacob's room. He's wearing Mickey Mouse socks, a diaper, and a tube snakes out of his chest. His tiny body shakes in rhythm with the oscillator pumping air in and out of his lungs.
What's he like? What's his personality like?
Jacob he's a character of his own. He's a happy, they all call him sweet boy because he's really sweet when he's up. But at the same time, if he doesn't like something, he'll give you a dirty look.
Doctors here call him a miracle baby. Jacob was born dangerously early, at 25 weeks, and he has chronic lung disease from being on a breathing machine his whole life. But his mother, Roxanne, says he's still doing a lot better than he was.
Right now he's in 7'7". He's a big boy.
That's 7 pounds, 7 ounces?
Mm-hmm, yes. He looks like a baby now.
When Jacob was born, he weighed 1 pound, 9 ounces. His story begins in Puerto Rico, just 3 months before Hurricane Maria.
Jacob was born in a hospital in Ponce, After that, the first hour, they told us, you know, the NICU that we have here, it's not the level that Jacob needs. We're not used to this kind of baby so small. So we need to transfer him to another hospital.
Jacob ended up on the top floor of the pediatric hospital at Central Medico in San Juan. Then Hurricane Maria shredded the roof.
The light went off in the hospital while we were there. And the generator took 43 seconds to turn on. Because I count them, I was nervous. I was like, why is it taking so long? My baby depends on full life support.
Roxanne says conditions at the hospital got worse. Jacob and the other babies were moved to another floor. Mold crept into the building and into Jacob's ventilator line.
I was like, no, I know it's not happening. I asked the baby's dad, I was like, can I get a wipe? So he gave me a wipe. I cleaned it in the outside. It wasn't in the outside, it was in the inside.
For some perspective, I looked into what happened with hospitals after Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans. At one comparable to Central Medico, all of the patients were evacuated to Atlanta, and the facility never reopened. The head of Global Environmental Health Sciences at Tulane University told me that's because once it grows, toxic mold will always come back. In Puerto Rico after Maria, many of the small hospitals closed, but the one where Jacob was stayed open because there's nowhere else to go. That's despite indoor mold levels across the city more than doubling.
And I was like, if Jacob stays here, he's not going to make it.
Baby Jacob's family spent the following 2 months appealing to the government for a medical evacuation. His mom just wanted him off the island.
So wherever, you know?
And then they got it to go to Georgia. When Roxanne heard that, she assumed Atlanta, the state's biggest city and a hub for healthcare.
The pilot was the one. He was like, you're not going to Atlanta. You're going to Macon. And I was like, where in the world is Macon? I mean, I'm from Puerto Rico. I know some from other states because I lived in the states before. But where is Macon?
Macon's a town of about 90,000 in central Georgia. When they land, doctors at the main hospital hook Jacob up to a mold-free breathing machine. It's a better situation all around, but not enough. Doctors recommend he go elsewhere for specialty care beyond what they can offer for his chronic lung disease. He might even need a lung transplant. But like his health, baby Jacob's insurance is precarious. His doctors want him to go to a hospital in Houston. Getting another transfer, the family's told, will take months.
And everything just stood like that, like, you know, back and forth, back and forth.
A special program through FEMA extended Jacob's Puerto Rico Medicaid benefits. But off the island, which hospitals will take him depends on how and if they'll get reimbursed. That negotiation keeps baby Jacob and his mom waiting.
It's not that I want to transfer him to Texas. It's that he needs to be transferred. I was like, you know what? Puerto Rico is not an option.
In the months since the storm and Jacob's birth, some hospitals in Puerto Rico are up and running again. But at the University of Puerto Rico, Wendy Matos says health facilities across the island are still wrecked, leaving patients like Jacob especially vulnerable to infections.
Even though they are enforcing the cleaning hands protocols and all the safety measures, the babies are so fragile that they are getting infected.
Baby Jacob won't go back to Puerto Rico. Not yet, anyway. Before all this, his mom, Roxanne, was a school teacher raising a daughter. But now, it's like their lives are on hold, and every day is a struggle.
Like, some people ask me, Mom, don't you get tired? I get tired, but I think, I mean, Jacob's been there fighting every single day, every single minute, every single second. So as long as he keeps on doing that, I'm going to keep on doing it with him.
Fast forward from when I meet them in Georgia. Baby Jacob did make it to Texas for more specialized care. Roxanne's made it there too. And she's getting ready for another milestone in his life, his first birthday. Her wish, for him to get well and to leave the hospitals behind.
Emily Cureton reported that story.
Our next story is about the impact of these storms on the shipping industry. In late September of 2015, just about 3 years ago, the SS El Faro, a container ship, was getting ready to ship out from Jacksonville, Florida. She was headed to Puerto Rico with a crew of 33 men and women. The ship was loaded with cars, trucks, and tons of food. There was a tropical storm forming that would eventually turn into Hurricane Joaquin, but at the time, it still appeared that it would dissipate. So the ship's captain, Michael Davidson, decides to head out.
And that wasn't a mistake. I mean, a ship in port is a ship losing money. You have to move.
That's Rachel Slade. Her new book about the El Faro is called Into the Raging Sea. So the El Faro traveled all night and reached the northernmost tip of the Bahamas. Here, Captain Davidson faced a decision: change course to avoid the storm or keep going straight to San Juan.
And he looked at his weather forecast again, and the problem was he had conflicting information.
He was getting info from the National Hurricane Center, but there was also another system on board called Bon Voyage, which was the one the captain relied on.
What he didn't know was that the Bon Voyage system was actually repackaging the National Hurricane Center's forecast, which, as you can imagine, took several hours. So every time he got an update for his Bon Voyage system, it was woefully out of date. And when you're talking about a hurricane that's building so quickly, in fact, that the National Hurricane Center couldn't keep up, every single hour made a difference. His information, the information that he stuck by to the end, was garbage.
On the system, it looked like the ship would avoid the hurricane by staying on its course. What happened next on the SS El Faro is documented on the ship's black box, which recorded all of the conversations on the bridge and was later recovered.
We have conversations between the officers, the captain, and the helmsman for 26 hours leading up to the final moments of the ship. And what we discover is that the captain would come up to the bridge and he would say, "Everything is fine. I know we're headed for the storm, but we're going to be fine. It's going to shoot north. We're going to get close, but we're never going to go through it." And meanwhile, throughout the day, his officers are looking at different information and they're seeing a very different story, which is that they're headed, in fact, straight for the storm and that the storm is building.
The crew is discussing these discrepancies and they keep trying to convince the captain to reconsider the route. They still have options to get away, but the captain refuses.
And in fact, at 8 o'clock at night, he goes downstairs to his stateroom and doesn't come back up.
Why not? What was he doing?
We don't know what he was doing because we don't have microphones down there, but we do know that 11:30 at night, third mate Jeremy Ream looks at the latest forecast coming out of the National Hurricane Center, and he sees that that hurricane has not budged from its southwest trajectory. So he calls up his captain, and we have one side of that conversation, and he says, "I've plotted it out. We are on a collision course. We need to change course." Now, we don't know what the captain said, but Jeremy gets off the phone and he turns to his helmsman. Now remember, they're in the dark. The ship's bridge at night is dark. They're illuminated only by their instruments and they're staring out to the sea that's starting to kick up. And Jeremy turns to his helmsman, Jack Jackson, and says, "An expletive?" And then he says, "He said to run it," meaning run our course.
And I guess on a ship, it's the power structure is much like in the military, right? So if you go against your captain's orders, that's mutiny.
Exactly. So remember that in the 19th, up until the 19th century, mutiny was punishable by death. And although, of course, that has changed, you do not want to be insubordinate. The U.S. Merchant Marine is quasi-military in that respect, and nothing has changed since Moby Dick. The captain is God on the ship.
In the early morning hours of October 1st, 2015, the storm is pummeling the ship. Crew members can feel waves smash against the sides. The ship is leaning.
And within just a few hours, they would be hitting that hurricane's eye wall, which is the 30-mile radius wall around the eye of the storm. It's the most concentrated part of the storm from a power perspective.
At what point does the captain realize his mistake? Do we know that?
He never admits his mistake. So even up to the end, he still thinks that they're going to be okay. And in fact, his emergency call at 7:10 in the morning to Jacksonville is an absolutely riveting moment. And he basically says, we're taking on water. We have a pronounced list. That should have been alarming. We're going to push all of our emergency buttons, but we're not abandoning ship yet.
And then the SS El Faro starts to sink. There were no survivors.
That's right. I think by that time, by the time he called all to abandon ship, the ship is listing so far and they lose propulsion, it's way too late for anybody to be saved.
Did they find their bodies?
So the search and rescue was harrowing. The U.S. Coast Guard sent all kinds of assets in to try to find this ship. She just really disappeared. They did find a debris field. They eventually found one of the open lifeboats that were aboard. They found a life ring. There were no survivors, and we have no bodies, and all was lost.
Has anything been learned from what happened here? Has anything changed based on this terrible accident?
The shipping industry has always pushed back on regulations. I mean, it just seems outrageous that in this day and age, a U.S. vessel was carrying lifeboats just like those on the Titanic. Nowadays, if you look at international ships, not under the U.S. flag, you'll see all of them carry enclosed lifeboats. And if there had been enclosed lifeboats on El Faro, those mariners would have had a chance.
Because they would have been better protected? Or what's the protection those offer?
So these look basically like the Yellow Submarine. You remember that little compact submarine from the Beatles. But it's bright red. And it's watertight, and it has a little engine on it. And if these mariners had had that, they could have gotten inside, sealed it, and they would have been knocked around, of course, by these 130-mile-per-hour winds and 30-foot waves, but they would not have sunk.
In the wake of the accident, families of those who died pushed for changes in rules, for example, allowing sailors to use a ship's satellite phone without having to ask permission from the captain. But Rachel says none of the proposed changes have been made, and right now there is an effort underway to further deregulate the shipping industry. Rachel Slade is the author of Into the Raging Sea, 33 Mariners, One Megastorm, and the Sinking of El Faro. We've been talking about hurricanes, and our last story takes us back to Puerto Rico, where so many challenges remain since Maria hit the island. One problem is a pest biting people and keeping them up at night. Sierra Ortiz Blanes grew up in Puerto Rico, and she has this story.
Calle is home to about 45,000 people. The city is nestled in the Cordillera Central, a large mountain chain that runs east to west. Usually, the city is peaceful and quiet. Then, Hurricane Maria hit.
At the same time, we didn't have water, we didn't have electricity. There were these black mosquitoes with orange heads that made our lives impossible.
Carmen Coto has lived in Calle her entire life. I got in touch with her over the phone. It's months and months after the big storm, but because there was another power outage days before, Carmen's cell phone signal is spotty. She's a little hard to understand. Carmen says, on top of the electricity and water being out, her family had to deal with another stress, mosquitoes.
It's very uncomfortable to sleep with a mosquito buzzing in your ears and not be able to sleep peacefully without electricity.
Carmen's neighbors tell her they're also losing sleep. The lack of rest is making people irritable, and that sleep deprivation has made it harder to deal with the everyday issues that come up among family, partners, and friends. Mosquitoes have always been a problem in Puerto Rico, and torrential rains left pools of still water that weren't there before. It's been hard to determine the size of the mosquito population or how much of a health threat the bugs will be this summer. Much of the available information is conflicting. The Centers for Disease Control warned about a potential uptick in disease-carrying mosquitoes, But, as of February, Puerto Rico's Department of Health hasn't documented any cases of chikungunya, Zika, or dengue. Doctors and scientists on the island say they're a bit suspicious of that finding. The Department of Health's testing lab hasn't been fully functional since Maria, which means the island's vector and illness tracking system may not be up to speed with what people are actually experiencing in their communities.
You have thousands and thousands of mosquito breeding grounds that you didn't have before.
That's Fernando Silva. He's head of the Puerto Rico Institute of Sciences for Conservation. His group is an NGO that uses educational programs to help people get back on their feet. As Fernando traveled to different communities around the island, he heard about the sleeplessness and unrest mosquitoes are causing. To get rid of the bugs, people have been overusing commercial chemical repellents and making their own home remedies. Locals take the sweet meat from coconuts, stuff it into an aluminum can, and light the whole thing on fire. The smell on the smoke is supposed to chase the mosquitoes away, but the fumes are toxic for people too. Fernando says the mosquito problem is going unnoticed because it largely affects poor rural communities.
They aren't the people that governing politicians respond to when it comes to advocating or making policy.
Without government support, Boricuas are starting to take matters into their own hands. Rosita Cambó is a community leader who lives in Barrio Las Vegas, another mountain neighborhood in Calle.
We contacted Fernando Silva a few weeks after the hurricane passed because he comes with initiatives to help people out.
Fernando says people in other hot, buggy places have used a simple, cheap solution for a long time, mosquito nets.
It's one of humanity's oldest technologies.
Fernando started out working with three barrios around the island, teaching people how to make the nets. Soon, the loosely formed group was called Las Tres Mosquiteras. You might recognize the play on words. The name refers to both the mosquito nets and the three neighborhoods that started making them. Barrio Las Vegas in Calle, where Rosita Cambó is from, is one of the originals. Rosita says the nets are easy to make, and in these times where the power comes and goes, they're practical.
Exactly. It isn't necessary to have electricity or sewing machines.
Fernando Silva leads workshops that educate folks on mosquito-borne illnesses. He wants them to be able to make bed nets long after he's gone. Here he is again.
The community does not have to wait for anyone to take care of a problem like this one. It creates a tool for the protection of health and the lives of people that is in their hands to make.
Fernando says what started with three communities is now over 100. People are equipped with more resources, he says, to take charge of their health.
It foments the sensation of, you know, feeling useful in this process of community-wide recovery. It's an act of love.
It's Puerto Ricans caring for themselves, doing something when that can feel impossible. For The Pulse, I'm Cira Ortiz Blanes.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alana Gordon, Irina Zhorov, Alan Yu, and Liz Tung. Mike Moscarelli is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Alex Stern is our associate producer. Tanya English is our editorial director. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated health care. Penn Medicine supports The Pulse. Some of us live for the future, but what if tomorrow is too late? That's why today at Penn Medicine, their breakthroughs are helping to change lives. Healthy cells can now find and eliminate cancer cells. Focused ultrasound is taking the place of brain surgery to correct essential tremor. And vision is being restored using a genetic treatment. That's why your life is worth Penn Medicine. Learn more at PennMedicine.org.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at PartnersWithAPurpose.org. Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.